The Airplane Geeks podcast is proudly sponsored by the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association. Visit aopa.org/learn-to-fly for your introduction to the exciting world of aviation and flight. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 226 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and as always, I'm joined by some brilliant co-hosts. First, we have David Vanderhoof from the What Just Flew By blog. Hi, David.
Hey, Max. Greeting from very warm Philadelphia, where we were in the high 60s today, unseasonable weather for December. I hope we get to some real Christmas weather shortly, but it's been kind of a bizarre couple of days.
Also with us is Rob Mark from the Jetwine blog.
Well, in Chicago, it's the first week of December, and it was 71 degrees.
Oh my gosh. Beat out David.
Climate change.
It's ridiculous. All right, well, our guest this episode, however, is not ridiculous. He's Jason Blair, the executive director of the National Association of Flight Instructors. Jason, welcome to the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Thanks for having me with you tonight. And I'm actually in what turned out to be the sunny spot for today, Washington, D.C., to do a little bit of NAFI work and spend some time in the nation's capital with the FAA this week and a bunch of other aviation folks. So I left fog in Michigan, where Rob said it was not too far away. In Chicago, they're 70. It's about the same in D.C., so we're kind of glad to have nice warm weather here, and I got a feeling it's not going to last too much longer, considering the time of the year.
That's right. Now, you're in D.C. quite a bit, aren't you, speaking with the FAA and other advisory councils, the TSA and so forth? You must spend quite a bit of time in Washington.
You know, I do spend a fair amount of time here. It's usually at least once a month or so that I end up in the Capitol. And a lot of times it is with FAA and other industry folks, but certainly sometimes with TSA, Homeland Security type stuff relating to flight training. Every once in a while, we end up talking with some of the folks on the Hill, especially a little bit as of late, as we've considered some of the changes in pilot training requirements that came as a result of congressional efforts. But much of the time is spent with the regulatory agencies that we work with, trying to help influence training policy for the country.
Fascinating. Now, we're going to talk a lot about that coming up. First, though, we have some aviation news from the past week that we want to talk about a little bit. Also, later on, we've got David with his Aircraft of the Week. Now, David, we had quite a lot of voting by our listeners, I think, for the winner this week. Who were the contestants?
Yeah, evidently, we're people are liking this dogfight of the week. We had the Su-42 Berkut swept wing fighter, and we had the winner, the Boeing C-32. Oh, sorry. That's right, airliner geeks, the Boeing 757.
Fantastic. Look forward to that.
Yeah, you know why you had that fight, don't you, David? Because somebody thought the Boeing was a Republican airplane and the Sukhoi was the Democrat airplane.
Oh, they couldn't agree, huh?
I thought it was more of a Cold War, Soviet versus American.
Did they push the Soviet airplane off the cliff? Or, oh, no, maybe I'm getting things mixed up here. All right, never mind.
Okay, Mr. Politically Correct.
All right, we also have coming up Steve and Grant from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast with their Australia Desk report. And, of course, we have Peter Johnson with his Across the Pond segment, bringing us the European side of aviation. Before we get started, though, I think, Rob, you wanted to mention something that we'd like to ask our listeners to do for us.
Is that the part where I ask them to donate money to my daughter's college fund?
No, not that part.
Oh, the other thing.
Yes, yes.
Right. Hey, we had this great idea that instead of just saying Merry Christmas in 2 or 3 weeks when it gets to be Christmas, which is what we always do, and And David, of course, will be singing Christmas carols, which makes Max and I turn our headphones down. But sorry, David. But no, this year we thought it would be fun so that if any of you from any part of the world speak another language, tell us how you say Merry Christmas or Happy Holidays in your language, and maybe say it in an MP3 file and send us the MP3 file, and we'll put them into that last show of right there before Christmas. And Max, I would say we'd probably need the person's name and their city and country. Right. And, you know, where they, how they listen to the Airplane Geeks, maybe do a little program research. And
sure.
I don't know, where would they, if they had an MP3 file, where would they send it to?
They could email that to us. Just use our normal email address. Again, that's thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. Just email us an MP3 file. If you don't have a way to do that on your computer or you'd prefer not to, you can call our listener line, which is 361-GEEKS-01, and you can leave us a recorded message there.
So cool. So we expect hundreds of these things. And David, I'm sure you'll probably post that note up on Facebook later on or something, huh?
Yes, boss.
Okay.
Cool.
All right. Well, listen, why don't we get started with the aviation news from the past week? Is everyone ready?
Dun, dun. Oh, right. Sorry. You're going to play the music.
All right. Our first story comes from the Journal Times. This is Feds Target Small Plane Safety, General Aviation on NTSB's Most Wanted List. Now, the NTSB, the National Transportation Safety Board, investigates about 1,500 general aviation accidents each year. And they've put improving aviation safety on its Most Wanted Targets list. Now, this is something that's been kind of an issue for a little while, isn't that right? I mean, this isn't a problem that's just surfaced recently.
God, no, I wish it. I can't say wish it were. I mean, but no, it has been a fairly consistent problem, and it drives flight instructors crazy, which I'm sure we'll get Jason's opinion here in a second. But again, the one thing that NTSB has really been upset about is that it just seems to be rock steady. We just seem to keep hurting the same number of people in small airplanes every year. And so I think it's time that they focused a little harder on that. At least that's their plan. I don't know. Jason, maybe you've got some thoughts on that.
You know, I do. And this is actually something that we've worked with the NTSB a little bit. Also work with a group called the General Aviation Joint Steering Committee, which is representatives from FAA, from NTSB, and from a number of other aviation organizations. And we do look at this very, very carefully to look at that accident rate. And you're absolutely right. It has stayed very, very level. We've seen a general downward trend in numbers of fatal accidents, but it's been not necessarily at a rate that is at the same of even our usage of aircraft. And I think there's some questions of whether our number of accidents and fatal accidents per hours flown is really getting any better. So it's something that we do need to get better at. And I think if we look at economic considerations as people fly less based on, you know, how much gas costs and whether they want to go flying and whether they can afford to do it, if we fly less, we get less safe. So we've got to figure out a way to find a way to get that number down and hurt less people flying and keep ourselves safe in general aviation if we want to be able to feel safe bringing our family and friends with us.
Sure. And I think one of the issues that's helped or let's say caused the NTSB to focus on this is that there has been such a spectacular reduction in the number of not just accidents, but certainly fatalities in the air carrier, the Part 121 regime. And, I mean, 10 or 12 years ago, when they said they wanted to reduce the accident rate to nil, you know, people said, yeah, okay, right, that's going to happen. But, I mean, it has been, I don't think there's been a fatal air carrier accident in the U.S. in 2012. I don't No, I don't think there was in 2011 either. And of course, now they're saying, well, if we can do it with those airplanes, why can't we do it with these? Well, because the pilots are much different. And that's, you know, the training issue that the instructors are constantly looking at.
Yeah, and the article says that more than 400 pilots and passengers are killed annually. That's a big number.
Sure, if we had that number in air carrier accidents.
Go ahead, Jason.
Well, I think one of the things that, you know, we had kind of sat in a room one day with a couple of aviation leaders, and we all kind of said, okay, so how many people have known somebody who's died in an aircraft? And boy, there wasn't anybody in the room that didn't raise their hand. And
wow.
We roughly quantified, you know, if a general aviation pilot spent 3,000 to 4,000 hours of flying time in their GA career, it came out, and this was very, very rough math, but, you know, more than 1 in 20 people would end up dead. And that's pretty scary.
That is scary.
So I think having it on the NTSB's list and having it on, you know, AOPA looking at this and having NAF look at it and having everybody point the finger at it keeps it in our mind. And I think that's important. The more we look at it, the more we pay attention to it and not push it aside and just assume it won't be us. Because if we work to make sure it's not us, maybe we knock that number down a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. I'm sure that there are a number of different causes for these accidents. You mentioned, you know, lack of flying or reduced flying and not being as current as maybe people have been in the past or would be otherwise. There's probably a lot of reasons for these. How about on the training side? Is quality of training an issue here, do you think?
You know, I think training in general does a pretty good job. And what's interesting, when we looked at it, there's a group working under the General Aviation Joint Steering Committee right now. It's basically an analysis team, and it's amazing how many of the accidents, and by I say how many, I mean way better than 40%, end up loss of control. And in a lot of cases, it's stall spin on final, it's stall spin on takeoff. I mean, we're hurting ourselves in very much the same way we always have, and our accident ratios in terms of how we do it over the years haven't changed that much. So. I don't know that it's always training. I think sometimes the further you get from training, the more likely it is that you're going to have one of those accidents. But we need to keep that recurrent. And, you know, one of the ways we can do that is to make sure when we do flight reviews with people, they're not pencil whipped. It's we're actually going to talk about some of the things that hurt us and kill us.
Sure.
And make sure that we go over those areas and make sure people are safe continuing forward.
Well, probably. You know, go ahead, Rob.
I was going to say, surprisingly, too, Jason mentioned a good point about loss of control. If you look at air carrier accidents outside of the United States, where the numbers are much, much higher than here in the States, some regions of the world like Africa, I think they're four times as high, and the same in Russia and places like that. Loss of control is still the primary cause, and so we're not just talking about somebody out in their 150, you know, doing stall spin. Yes, that's happening, but the scary part is that there are people in other parts of the world learning to fly that are having very similar problems where they something happens that they don't know how to get themselves out of, even in a big airplane.
All right, well, because the NTSB investigates all these things, I got to believe that there's a wealth of data concerning these accidents. So, you know, that's maybe the good news is that, you know, if you don't have information about, you know, what happened and why, it's kind of difficult to understand causes. But maybe in this case, with the NTSB data, that ought to represent a good starting point to make some progress.
Well, I think you hope so. Yeah. But of course, it's very much like driving a car in the sense that people will read stories in the newspaper or hear a story on the radio or the telly or something and say, wow, that was really an awful situation. They had that 30 car pileup. Where was that? Was that in Kentucky last week?
No, there was a big one in Texas recently.
Right? Maybe that's what it was. I was thinking
the fog.
You know, and people say, yeah, oh, that is, it's awful. But they don't actually believe that they could ever do anything that could lead them into a situation like that.
Yeah.
And sometimes I have to admit, I've flown with pilots that that I would not recertify on a biannual because I said, man, this guy's going to kill himself some of these days. And it's not going, he's not going there on my signature. And some of these people get really upset with that.
All right. Well, let's move on to our next story. This is a military story. This is from the Navy, actually. First X-47B UCAS catapult launch makes naval aviation history. And we saw just recently that this X-47B unmanned combat air system, UCAS, the demonstrator successfully completed a land-based catapult launch. There's a really great video of that launch in the article. You can find that in the show notes. And I thought it was particularly interesting to watch one of the guys do some serious fist pumping after this unmanned airplane was launched into the air. David, this is kind of a significant event, isn't it?
It's getting closer. We're going to have unmanned aircraft on aircraft carriers. Step one is to be able to prove that it can launch itself off via a carrier deck. Although this is a land-based one, but the technology is the same. And then the next step will be, after we start doing that, we'll be doing arrested landings by itself. And eventually, when we're comfortable enough, we'll move it to an aircraft carrier and repeat the processes there. And then it opens the world. Then the tough part comes. If you go back to one of my interviews from Patuxent River, they said what the biggest challenge wasn't launching it off the carrier, wasn't landing it on the carrier, but what to do with it on the carrier, which is taxiing around an unmanned aircraft on a football field when it becomes a oversized remote control car.
Yeah, exactly.
That'll be the net. Well, it literally, the airplane gives its autonomy over to a guy that holds a box like a radio controlled car or a radio controlled airplane to taxi it on the flight deck. But, well, we're now launching unmanned aircraft using catapults, which is more than I can say for the Chinese, but more about that later.
David, you know, of course, what engine is in that X-47B.
Would that be a Pratt & Whitney engine?
Absolutely. Well, yes, absolutely. In fact, it's the F-100-220, actually 220U. Which is essentially the same engine that you'd find in a F-15 or an F-16. But the variant they use in the X-47B is this -220U does not include an afterburner. But otherwise, it's basically an F-15 or F-16 motor.
And that's been a motor that's been around a long time at this point.
Sure has.
40-plus years.
Yeah, it's a long time. It's a very long time. All right, David mentioned China, but let's start off talking about general aviation in China. You know, it was interesting back at almost a month ago, November 8th, there was an article in Flight Global titled General Aviation Waiting for the Dawn, where they said that despite some promising signs, China is still wary about embracing general aviation. Says this makes any kind of progress a significant challenge. So I don't know if the Chinese were reading Flight Global or not, but pretty soon after that, kind of a series of articles came out in China Daily. One is general aviation set for takeoff as more airspace is available. And this talks about the growing government support for the sector. They noted that a little over 500,000 hours of flight were recorded in general aviation in China in 2011, and they expect that to rise to 2 million hours by 2020. And another China Daily piece talked about training grants. The Civil Aviation Authority is going to offer training grants for general aviation pilot training. These amount to a little under $20,000, $120,000 yuan. Which is no small amount in China. And they're looking at the supply of pilots in China in the across the general aviation industry, and they're looking to offer some grants to boost that. And then a final piece from China Daily, sky's the limit for booming general aviation sector. We had the recent China International Air Show in Zhuhai, And at that event, a number of companies talked about investments they're making in the general aviation and the opportunities they see ahead. It's the Chinese are taking this really seriously. One, you know, since we're kind of talking about flight training in general this episode, one thought that occurred to me is, you know, with this at least anticipated rapid growth in the number of general aviation pilots in China, what kind of challenges from a training standpoint do you think that represents?
I have a friend that was over at the air show there a couple weeks ago in China, and she was doing some work for one of the magazines I know, and listening to lots of people talk about GA, and then I've gotten some input from some other sources over there, and of course they do not train for, again, this is what I am surmising from what I'm hearing, because I have never been there. But it seems as if the training regime there is different from what we have here, and that there's a great deal of ground school, a great deal of academics, and of course any of our pilot friends that fly in Europe already know that a pilot license, pilot certificate over here looks like a gift, ground school wise, compared to what they have to go through to meet the regs over there. But still, I have seen stories of airplanes that are sitting on the ground over there in China because they don't have enough people to drive them. And so the Boeing figures that came out, what, about 2 months ago, I think, showed most of the growth, well into the six-figure pilot requirements happening in Asia, what do they call it? Australasia or something?
Australia.
I can never get that right. We got to have Steve Fisher Grant on board for that. But and they have a real problem. We have a problem here, but they're going to have an even bigger problem because they don't have enough trained people to fly the airplanes. And of course, the system, while it is opening up, it's still not even remotely close to the kind of, I think I'll take a 172 out for a ride today from Beijing International. I'll just go off to the FBO and get the airplane, go fly around for an hour. It doesn't work like that because the PRC military over there in China is still very, very much in control of the airspace. And while they may be letting up, it's still pretty slow from what I've heard.
Hmm. Jason, is there any kind of international standards for training, or is each country left on its own when it comes to requirements for pilot training?
You know, I think there's a couple answers to that. In many cases, the countries have their own standards, and obviously we do have a couple of larger international standards, JAA being one of them. But in many cases, a lot of the countries do outsource their training to United States providers of training for the base stuff. You know, people come here and get their initial pilot certificates a lot of times through commercial, and then go back to their home countries. And as a matter of fact, we've got some base information out of the FAA that a little over 20% on average of the certificates done here in the United States every year are done to non-U.S. national students. So they're people that are coming here, getting trained, and then going back to their home countries. And, you know, you look at China, and I think there's a lot that is going to need to open up there in terms of GA for training, but also in general, if GA is going to be an active part of their community as it has been here for personal use. But if you go a little bit further south into Southeast Asia out there, and you look at some of the other countries, they're a little bit further ahead too. If you think about some of the Australasia, areas, India, China, are parts of it. Obviously, Indonesia is a part of it. All of those areas are growing areas of aviation where aviation travel is really how things move. And because of the distances involved, and they are looking to try and get domestic pilots involved there, and the training markets is changing there. And in many cases, they model on the U.S. system, but they do have their own, intricacies there. I cannot tell you that there is one single international standard. It is something that is a fit as it needs to fit type of approach.
Actually, can I throw in one other piece that just keeps me up at night thinking about this?
Sure, Rob.
we were just talking about the NTSB before and how they're going to look at the general aviation accident rate in this country. And of course, we have neighbors. We have the Transportation Safety Board of Canada. We have the group in the UK, the Air Accidents Board. We have a large proactive group in Australia and a number of other places. In China, nobody knows what is going on. We really have no idea at all how they track accidents, how they investigate them. And right now, and I don't mean this to sound terrible, but it probably will. You know, the aircraft manufacturers are there to build airplanes and sell them. And if they sell them in China, they're just as happy to sell them in China as they are in South America or Alaska or Europe. But again, the infrastructure of guiding the safety system there is really going to start knocking heads with the kind of standards we bring from the West. If more and more contract people go over there to fly while the Chinese are getting their pilot levels up to strength, a lot of these Western pilots are going to be bringing what they believe are the standard safety standards and investigatory kinds of practices as well. And from what we can tell, I can't say that they don't exist, but everything is pretty secret over there. So we don't really have much of an idea of what's happening on that front.
That's interesting. Yeah, well, this is obviously a big market for aviation. The Chinese have made it very clear that they want to develop their commercial, their general, and their military aviation capability. So, it will be, hopefully that those things will develop in a way that's, appropriate and safe and, looks to the long term and the safety of the pilots and passengers as well. On the military side, David, we had a little bit of interesting news. Again, going back to naval aviation from the Chinese this past week, didn't we?
They announced that they actually have an aircraft carrier and completed operations off of that aircraft carrier. The aircraft carrier is known as the Liaoning, which actually was formerly known as the Varieg or the Admiral Kuznetsov. The Chinese didn't build it. They bought it. After the Cold War, the Soviets decided that they couldn't afford to keep their aircraft carriers, and they sold the both of them. One is in the process of being retrofitted in India. The other was retrofitted in China, and that was they had completed five pilots completed carrier takeoffs and landings last week off of the Chinese aircraft carrier. They were using J-15s, which in effect are SU-33s or SU-27Ks. They're flankers, but they're navalized flankers. They have canards and they have folding wings and folding tailplanes. And interesting enough, this was such an uproar that the Chinese actually had an aircraft carrier to take off and landings on. I need to tell everybody that the Soviets did it with the same aircraft carrier back on November 1st, 1989. So what the Chinese did was take a 30-year-old carrier and recreate a 30-year-old event. We had John Arvin, one of our vocal listeners, wanted to know a little bit more about what we thought about it. And my opinion of the subject was, did I mention the United States has been flying jets off aircraft carriers since 1946? Most countries have aircraft carriers. The fact that China's getting one is not the crisis that everyone seems to be making it out to be. The United States have 11 currently, of which China now has one. And it's going to take a long time to learn how to operate a carrier at sea. It's something we've been doing forever and we take it for granted. But if you are a country starting out, there's a lot of stuff to learn. And in fact, it's the reason why the Russians sold their aircraft carriers. They weren't capable of getting it right. They never were able to get catapults to work right. So they went with ski ramp technology, which the Liaoning still carries. the flankers or the J-15s are, again, are 30-year-old technology. So it's going to be an interesting watching it go on. But in my humble opinion, China having an aircraft carrier, good for them. They've joined the nations of India, France, Argentina, Italy, Great Britain. Multiple nations have one or maybe two aircraft carriers. It'll be a long time before they play in the ballpark of the United States.
Yeah, these are their baby steps, I guess.
Absolutely. Well,
and David, didn't we have a big retirement this week? Didn't they retire the Enterprise?
We did retire our 50-year-old nuclear aircraft carrier, the Enterprise, which was the very first and our largest aircraft carrier ever built. But unfortunately, she is not going to a museum. Nuclear reactors have to be scrapped, and unfortunately, Enterprise will fade into the sunset, becoming razor blades and paper clips, which is unfortunate.
So then maybe what we should do is run an ad on the Airplane Geeks and say, hey, so you guys in Beijing, you want to buy an aircraft carrier?
Yeah, no power
plant.
Well,
you know,
needs a little work. Paint is good, but needs a little work. Actually, before we start, though, I want to know, because I heard Jason say something about working with the TSA people, and I want to know if they did they pat you down before you sat into the meeting, or
you know they don't. I gotta add a fun story though. So the TSA headquarters here in Washington D.C. is this really large set of buildings. I think it's actually like the old Atlantic Bell buildings. They're big. Couple buildings for a
we've given them $40 billion.
Well, we've given them a lot, and for a fairly new organization, they've gotten a lot. And so, being the Facebook friend that I am, I decided one day when I was walking in, I'd check in. And the first thing I noticed was when I went to check in, there was this gap on Google Earth. There was nothing there. And it's like, huh? Apparently, the TSA headquarters doesn't show up. So I went ahead and entered it as a new place. And I kind of wondered if I was going to get to go back out of the building after that, after I've blown their cover, per se.
Wow. But
nobody patted me down too bad. You do go through security like any government building. But nobody was too fresh with me. And they're actually pretty good folks up there. So I've enjoyed working with the GA folks there. They're logical. They're sensical. They are trying to keep us flying in a good sense. So the relationship.
You didn't get to meet TSA Bob, did you? Their blogger?
What's ahead?
They have a guy named TSA, wasn't it TSA?
Yeah, Blogger Bob. Bob.
They have a blogger, and
they so do, yeah.
So, TSA Bob.
Yeah.
We had him on a couple of years ago, I think, didn't we?
Yes, we did.
And interestingly enough, actually, a lot of the folks in the GA side there at TSA are pilots even, which is pretty cool to hear.
Oh, yeah, really? So. That's kind of surprising. I always just imagined a bunch of bureaucrats that, were kind of only remotely interested in aviation.
No, some of our active pilots. I like it. They actually go out and fly, on the weekend. Oh. So.
Great. Well,
okay. Wait a minute. Yeah. Jason, did you see their licenses, their certificates?
I didn't see their licenses.
Did they just tell you about it?
They seemed like they knew what they were talking about, so I'm going to go ahead and go with it.
All right. Well, we're speaking with Jason Blair. He's the executive director of the National Association of Flight Instructors. Now, Jason, I understand that you personally started flying at a pretty young age.
I did. I don't know what my parents' problem was, but they let me go really early. I think I just bothered them enough that they finally said, fine, go learn. And so I was 15 years old when I took my first flight lesson. I wanted the solo on my 16th birthday.
Yeah.
But I grew up in Upper Michigan, and my birthday's in January. And that time of the year, that can be a little tough. So I had to wait 4 extra days. And soloed in the first couple days of February. I think it was February 2nd, if I remember right. And got my license when I was 17 and never planned on being in aviation, and went and did a couple of degrees at a school with a large aviation program in unrelated aviation fields, and somehow managed to find my way back into aviation. And so I started pretty young. And I think once it's in your blood, you're kind of stuck.
When did you become a CFI?
I became a CFI, and I'm stretching back. It was probably 1998. I think I was a junior in college. So I had gotten my private, and then shortly after my freshman year of college, I got my instrument rating, and, like any good pilot, wanted to stay current. So I just kept training and got my commercial, and then I guess what's next? You become a CFI, right? So somewhere about then, while I was going through college, I got my CFI and started working on the weekends, doing some flight training as I was finishing my undergrad and then into my master's degree. So I've been a CFI, I think, since 1998 or 1999.
And what led you to the National Association of Flight Instructors?
You know, it's a bit of a fluke, actually. I owned a flight school and fixed-based operator for a while and had been a member of NAFI. I became a member very, very soon after I became a flight instructor. A friend recommended it to me. And I noticed they were looking for a new executive director one time and had some contact with a couple board members and basically made a call one day and said, "So what are you looking for? Is there something I can help, somebody I can help you find?" And they said, "Why, are you going to apply?" And that turned into a longer discussion, and he eventually ended up with me taking the position and starting to do the job there.
Maybe you can explain to our listeners sort of what the mission of NAFI is. What's the organization seeking to achieve?
Most of the time, what we're seeking to do is try and help flight instruction promote professionalism in the industry, and then also to work to make sure that the training that is conducted, you know, is done by folks that know what they're doing. So we try and give a lot of information back to our members as we work with the FAA, with other organizations, and generally work within the industry to help them stay aware of things that are changing, give them information along the way. And then certainly a part of it is to try and represent them back to those organizations as a collective as well. You know, we try and be a voice back to some of these organizations for what the industry needs and what the industry is looking for from those agencies and organizations to help them be successful too.
You know, let me throw a quick funny comment in here, because I have to give the disclaimer that I'm a NAFI member, and I don't know how long I've been a NAFI member, for a long time. But anyway, so not long ago, I renewed my membership, and I got this really cool certificate. In fact, you signed it, Jason. Did you know that?
I did, actually.
Yeah. And it says, for 37 years of professionalism. And so when Jason and I were on the phone the other day getting ready for the show here, I said, I didn't realize you guys had been around for 37 years. I somehow had a different time frame in mind. And he said, "What are you talking about?" And I said, "Well, it says 37 years of professionalism in aviation instruction," or something to that effect. And he said, "No, they're talking about you." And I said, "Me? I said, I haven't had a flight instructor certificate for 37 years. And we went back and checked the dates, and I'll be darned, Jason was right. 37 years sure comes and goes pretty quick. But it's been a lot of fun. And I really do admire the work that Jason does, because I think there are so many flight instructors that we produce that I have met that are just astounding educators. They really, really care. And it helps balance out for some people those instructors that just seem to want to check boxes to get done so they can get their soon-to-be 1,500 hours and go on to a real job. But trust me, if you don't train people right, the person in the other seat next to you someday might be somebody that was trained by some goofy person, and nobody wants to fly with them.
No. Now, you know, with all these, with the demand for pilots that we keep hearing about, do we have enough flight instructors to train all of these pilots that we think we need?
You know, that's a great question. I think if you look purely at the numbers, it seems commonsensical that we have enough flight instructors, actually. And if you look at the FAA's most recent numbers from, I think, 2012 came out, they say we have a little over 97,000 flight instructors that have an active CFI certificate. But what that doesn't take into account is some context, and many of those flight instructors are people that are working in other professional jobs in aviation. They might be an airline pilot, they might be a charter pilot, they might be flying for a corporation, and the flight instructor certificate is actually the only real pilot certificate, per se, that expires, and if you don't do something to keep it current, it goes away. So every 2 years, a flight instructor has to keep that certificate current by doing some sort of method to keep it, you know, active. Most do a flight instructor refresher course, or do so based on their sign-off of activity for training. But we've looked at some numbers, and we see typically somewhere between 12-15% of those have, in any given two-year period, actually signed somebody off for a practical test, or they've signed them off for a check ride. So many of those flight instructors are not actively instructing candidates toward a practical test. That doesn't account for those that are doing flight reviews, instrument proficiency checks, maybe insurance checkouts, things like that. The bigger question is not necessarily if we have enough flight instructors, but do we have enough flight training providers to actually provide enough bandwidth and enough training out there? And, you know, we think about how are we going to get those next generation of pilots, and we look at large university and collegiate programs, we look at large academy programs, and then we certainly have a variety of general aviation local training providers. So, you know, if we think Embry-Riddle, University of North Dakota, Purdue, Western Michigan University, those are some of the big universities. We think about Flight Safety International, or we think about ATP as some of the big academy environments, AeroSim being another one. And then it turns into this kind of hodgepodge, and we don't have a good way of quantifying what is our training capacity for how many local airports have one or two or three Cessna 172s, Piper Warriors, Cirrus SR20s, Diamond DA40s, whatever it happens to be, and how many people can we actually put through that system? So I think it's not necessarily a number of instructors, but it's what's our real training capacity. And I honestly, my gut tells me we don't have enough providers to really get us to where we need to be to meet that training need going forward. And more difficultly, we might be able to get the training portions done, but the experience pieces that we're going to need as people need to meet that 1,500-hour requirement is going to be even more difficult, because we can give them training, but they still need to find a way to gain the rest of that experience if they're going to find their way into the right seat or left seat of a commercial airline in the future.
That's very interesting, because that's probably the harder part, you know, of the resources you need to do the training and to develop good qualified pilots. That's probably the harder part.
I think it's actually one of the really, really hard parts. And you know, we wrote a white paper, myself and one other individual, Jonathan Fry, about 6 months ago. We released it back in March, if I remember right, probably a little bit more than 6 months now. And we kind of figured if you took just a basic airplane of $100 an hour Cessna 150 and you took their training time out of it and then said go buy the rest of the time, it was about $159,000 worth of time they were going to have to go buy to make up the difference. Pretty hard to justify and really hard to fund.
And I think another important point is that no one is ringing that alarm bell. I mean, some of us in the industry are, but in terms of the airlines, the regionals are certainly starting to get concerned. But I saw something after the Boeing figures came out, I don't know, like I said, 2 or 3 months back, that someone did some sort of arithmetic and said if we needed to produce enough pilots to meet the Boeing demand based on what they thought were the most active number of flight instructors available and the available resources, if we worked pretty hard, we still probably couldn't produce what they thought North America was going to need. But we're not even close to working very hard trying to, keeping the resources busy in any kind of a frenzied pace or anything like that right now, because there are still a lot of places, a lot of organizations and people that kind of like climate change. Oh, yeah. Okay, right. Pilot shortage. Yeah. Okay, it's coming. But it's going to hit, and when it does, it's going to be ugly.
Well, and I think that takes into, you know, that's one piece of it. The other is even the motivation for people to enter the career, even if we could
absolutely
ramp up and continue forward. I think we're running into a point where if you ask parent X, so do you think your son or daughter should go into an airline career? And by the way, you're going to spend $220,000 on this job training program of sorts that's going to get them to the point where they have 350 hours. At the end of it, they are not employable, and they got to go figure out how to spend some more money to get this. I think parents are going to start saying, you know, we'll go ahead and send you to college, but not for that.
Yeah, that's interesting. When we look at commercial aviation, you know, are people getting into that because they love flying, or are people getting into that as just a job, as a source of income? And do we see any shifts in the kinds of people who are, you know, seeking to become pilots these days?
You know, I think it's somewhat anecdotal. I don't have hard data for it, but we have seen less commercial pilots, in my own experience, coming back to the general aviation airports and flying on average. And I think it's become a little bit more job-like than it used to be passion-based. And certainly most of us very, very much love being in the air. And that's probably something that hurts us in many cases, because in many cases we're willing to work for peanuts. Sadly, almost actually peanuts out of the vending machine in reality some days. I think I've taken peanuts out of a vending machine as payment for a flight instruction job in the past. But, you know, love it. And I think that sometimes hurts us because we're willing to go no matter what, even if it's not cost effective. But we've got to find a way to make it something we can still be passionately involved in, but, you know, have dinner on the table at the same time.
Jason, maybe you can tell us a little bit about the Education Foundation.
Sure. We do have an AFI Education Foundation, and much of the time that foundation has worked to contribute the donations that come back. We have two pieces of NAFI. One is the primary membership organization, which is a nonprofit corporation, which funds many of the efforts that NAFI does. A magazine that we put out weekly newsletter to our members in digital format, and much of the work that I do. But we also have the foundation on the side, and that has supported some scholarship funds in the past. And one of the more regular things that we have supported with that has been the National Intercollegiate Flight Association, which is a competition of flight schools that are at the universities and colleges. And we've always supported some of their events as well. So the contributions that come in along with NAFI membership go to that foundation and do help promote and put some funds back into the aviation industry through those types of events also.
Hmm. How many members does NAFI have?
You know, right now we're just shy of 4,000, which is, you know, not a huge number, but most of our members are extremely active flight instructors. They're folks that are out there doing this on a regular basis. I'll take this moment for the pitch. Obviously, if anybody's listening who is a flight instructor and is a member, we'd certainly like you to visit nafinet.org and join today. We understand that not everybody gets to do this on a regular basis, and we're pretty happy for the members that we have that do stay pretty engaged.
It's a great organization. I like the fact that they're digging into stories that sometimes even I take for granted. And it was the one I saw one just was it the last issue, I think, Jason, where they talked about flight instruction in the days of the Wright brothers.
They did, actually. It was a little bit of a historical approach to it, and it's certainly before my and probably before your days as well. But, you know, to look back at how training has evolved is really kind of interesting to help us get a perspective on where we're at now.
Oh, and it has changed dramatically, really, just in the last decade in one sense, and in another sense, it hasn't changed at all. We still have very much the same kinds of performance standards when someone takes a check ride. I believe, Jason, you're an examiner. You'll have to call me on this. But we have all this new technology that just requires a tremendous amount of extra work on the part of the student and the instructor to understand and to be able to teach. Let's take a Garmin 430, for instance, which is a fairly common GPS comm receiver too these days. And there you can get yourself quite a corner if you really don't understand which button to flip and which screen to pull up and where to enter and where to clear. And I mean, and then you still have to fly the airplane. We've gotten a lot busier in the cockpit, I think, when we're training. The standards, I don't know, standards are still pretty much the same, I think, aren't they, Jason?
They are. You know, the completion standards are very, very much the same. But you're absolutely right. The methodology to get there has changed. And I do serve as an FAA examiner, and one of the places I do check rides with regularity at is at Western Michigan University. And up until a couple of years ago, they had the E1 package of the Avidyne Integra glass panel in their Cirrus SR20s. And they did an upgrade and changed some, you know, engine overhauls and swapped everything to the Avidyne R9 system in it. Same airframe, but I was lost as the examiner. I went and spent about 20 hours or plus in the box trainer just figuring out how to push buttons. And then not too long ago, I went up to Cirrus and did my CSIP training to learn a little bit about how they do that. And lo and behold, in the same Cirrus airframe, They had the Garmin Perspective system, and, you know, without some training, I was lost. So, you know, we do have it. It's incumbent on us as an instructor, and certainly me as an examiner, to understand how those systems work if I'm going to test them or we're going to train them. And, boy, it takes a lot more work. So we still have the same completion standards, and ILS still has to be, you know, don't break the minimums. Don't be above 500 or don't be above 100 above minimums when you get there, and stay within that that localizer. But how we do it changes, and it changes how we train, and changes how we teach as instructors, and certainly as examiners too. It takes a lot of work.
Jason, there's just one more question that I had that Rob has kind of touched on this in the past, but I'm interested in you know, your thoughts on this. Is if I'm out there and going to start looking for a flight instructor, how should I approach that? Who should I look for? How should I look for the right kind of flight instructor for me?
I think it's important that you treat it as an interview. And I think many times people go out to the closest airport and they find the first person that they talk to that says, yes, I'm a flight instructor. And they assume almost that they have to go with that person. And the instructor-student relationship is, it's very personalized. I mean, we spend a lot of time in an aircraft close together, sometimes closer than we do with our loved ones, you know, as we're jammed into a Cessna 150 together virtually on top of each other. And you've got to be with somebody that you're going to be able to communicate well, that you're going to be able to understand, but is still going to be able to provide you good quality instruction. And I think the best way to do that is to sit down and talk with that person about how they provide their training, what their schedule's like, you know, how are they actually going to set up a curriculum for you based on what your limitations are. And if you have somebody that you sit down and talk to and they say, oh, we'll just fly when we can and, you know, we'll get in the airplane and figure it out, I think that's probably not somebody that has really taken the time to develop an approach that's going to work for the individual. And I think it's important for any instructor, if they want to work with a student, to take the time to sit down, talk with them, find out what their personal commitments are for time. You know, if I sit down with a student and he says, I only have Saturday morning available, well, I'm going to have to go ahead and tailor my instruction to that. Let's talk about the homework I'm going to give them during the week and figure out how to make that Saturday in the morning valuable. If I find a student that says, I need to get this done because I'm working towards an airline job, okay, well, I'm going to have to sit down and let's talk about maybe flying 4 days a week. Maybe we're going to take 8 till noon every day of the week. Or maybe we're going to pick 3 days out of the week, you know, and really look at how those people's needs are and what the students' real abilities are going to be and how we're going to structure that approach. And do I have chosen materials that I'm going to use? Have I picked a curriculum? Have I picked a syllabus? And if these are questions that when somebody sits down and asks an instructor, so how do you teach? They don't have an answer to any of them. I think it might be time to look for a new instructor. You're going to want to find somebody that has taken the time to put together a professional approach to their training and is going to give you good value for the money you're going to spend. You're going to spend a lot of time and a lot of money with them. And in many cases, the lowest dollar local closest flight instructor may not be your best option. Find one that's going to go ahead and set that up for you, because I think in the long run, you'll be more efficient.
And I've heard some people say that if it's just not working out with your flight instructor, if you're just not making the connection and it's you're not getting the value that you need to get, then change. Don't feel compelled to, you know, stick it out with the, you know, the instructor that you start with.
Absolutely. And I think sometimes an instructor has that too. I've had students where I've had the conversation, I said, look, I don't know if we're getting where we need to be. Let's talk about whether I'm the right person for you too. And I think a good flight instructor should be willing to do that also.
Yeah, that sounds like the mark of a great flight instructor. All right, Jason, is there anything else about NAFI that we haven't covered that you want to mention for our listeners before we move on to some other stuff?
No, I think that you've given us a great opportunity to tell people a little bit about us tonight. And certainly, you know, knowing that we're out here doing this on the behalf of the flight training industry, is we're proud to do it. We're happy to do it. And we certainly look for all the support we can get along the way. And the best support we can get is people engaging and asking us questions and helping us, you know, prod the folks in the regulatory agencies to address what we need addressed.
All right. Give us the website again. And also, you're on Twitter, I believe.
I do use Twitter a little bit. NAFI uses Facebook a little bit more. But then the website is nafinet.org. We tried to get nafi.org, but the darn people have been fighting fires longer than we have at the National Association of Fire Inspectors. So nafinet.org. So certainly welcome to join us and you know, view some of the stuff that NAFI has on there. And love to have people's in interaction with us.
Great. Jason Blair, thank you very much.
We'll see you Saturday, right, Rob?
Well, I'm hoping... I'm still trying.
All right.
There's something going on in Western Michigan there at Kalamazoo that, well, we should mention that. Jason, I just think it's such an interesting talk that you guys are involved in there at Kalamazoo that it's worth mentioning.
Yeah, what's going on?
This Saturday, we're doing a dinner in Kalamazoo. It's a sponsorship dinner that benefits both NAFI and a foundation for aviation students at Southern Illinois University, which is actually a foundation that was selected by Captain Al Haynes. For anybody who doesn't remember, Captain Al Haynes was the pilot on United 232, who, along with his crew and certainly a number of other responders, made by far the best out of an emergency than certainly we think probably could have resulted in many other cases in Sioux City, Iowa there. He's going to be joining us for a special dinner to talk a little bit about teamwork in we're going to be talking a little about teamwork and training and how as teams work together, both flying and in training in general, that you know, aviation gets a little safer, a little bit better. So next Saturday on December 8th here, we're going to be putting together that dinner. And if anybody's interested, they can certainly find information on the NAFI website and join us for that dinner. It's a pretty special event. Captain Haynes has been doing this for a while, and we very, very much look forward to the event and having him speak to NAFI members and other attendees at the dinner.
Wow, sounds fantastic. Are you going, Rob?
Well, I'm trying. I may be able to bring one of the flying club airplanes, so I'm trying to get somebody to go with me because it's, you know, it's cool. I don't want to go by myself. It's kind of a long trip. Well, it's not a long drive, but it's more fun when you take somebody else with to hear this. Now, yeah. I've never heard Al Haynes speak. I hear he's really great.
Yeah, it sounds like it's going to be a good event.
I'm parking in front of the building, so there's no excuse.
Yeah. All right, Jason, thanks again.
My pleasure. Take care, guys.
All right. We'll see you. Yeah, that was great. I liked that. I enjoyed that.
Well, and Jason's he's a good guy because he's tied in with a lot of the things that are going on in terms of the training world in D.C., And so I think that one of the issues that's really important is that people think, oh, training, they're talking about little airplanes. Well, it's not, because this is how you start out before you get to the big airplanes. And so this is really quite I guess it could be a bottleneck if it doesn't flow very well. And people are really worried about the fact that we're not going to have enough folks to drive these airplanes.
Yeah, they should be too. And now here's David Vanderhoof, our official Airplane Geeks historian.
Thanks, Max. The Airplane Geeks airplane of the week, the Boeing 757, otherwise known as Dan's favorite airplane. Boeing in the early 1970s looked to continue with its successes with the then Boeing 727 trijet. Boeing looked at stretching the 727-200 to become the 727-300. United Airlines was to be the prime customer for the 727-300. The second choice was for a clean sheet design for an aircraft with two high bypass turbofans and a supercritical wing. This was called the 7N7. Originally, the 7N7 retained the T-tail of the 727, but that was eventually replaced with the conventional tail. Two versions of the 7N7 were going to be offered, the 7N7-100 and the 7N7-200. British Airways and Eastern Airlines became the launch customers for the 7N7-200 by ordering 40 in August of 1978. The orders were finalized in March of 1979. At that time, Boeing officially named the aircraft the 757-200. This launch would use the Rolls-Royce RB211 535Cs and would mark the first time that a Boeing aircraft would use a non-U.S. produced engine. Eventually, Delta would accept 60 of the 757-200s with Pratt & Whitney's 2037 engines. Also, surprisingly, General Electric CF6 was also offered. However, it was never dropped due to lack of purchasers. The 757 was to be a growth outgrowth of the 72. However, by the time the 75 was going into production, the 767 widebody was also. The 75 benefited from its bigger brother. Lessons learned from the 76 were applied to the 75. One of the most significant introductions was that of CRT, or cathode ray tubes. These provided enough information about systems that the flight engineer would be eliminated and the aircraft would only be flown by a pilot and first officer. Also, because of the similarity between both the 75 and 76 cockpits, it was extremely easy to qualify for both aircraft. The 75's wing were more efficient than the 727's and had less drag. The 757 was 2 feet longer than the 727, but could hold 50 more passengers. The aircraft had a substantially better performance in hot and high climates. On February 19, 1982, the first 75 took to the skies. Surprisingly, 1 week ahead of schedule. Flight testing concluded with the FAA giving its certification on December 21, 1982, 30 years ago this year. The CAA in Great Britain certified it on January 14, 1983. Eastern Airlines first flew its first flight, Atlanta to Tampa, with the aircraft on January 1st, 1983. And nothing looked better than a silver airplane with a blue hockey stick with a 757 on the side of it. In 1986, the FAA approved ETOPS for the 757 with the RB211 engines. In 1992, the ETOPS was approved with the Pratt & Whitney 2000 series engines. While most ETOPS were transatlantic, or ATA, or American Transair, operated ETOPS on a route from Tucson, Arizona to Honolulu, Hawaii. In December 19, 1992 and December 15, 1993, two accidents killed 11 were determined because of the 757 having severe wake turbulence. NASA eventually determined that the wake vortices that come off a 75 are even stronger than that of a 747 or a 767. In 1994, the FAA classified the 75 as a heavy, and it requires the same spacing as other jumbos, which makes it the only aircraft under 300,000 pounds to have that certification. The prime variant of the 757 is the 200, or 752. The total production of this and its subvariants is 913. The main passenger version is the -200. It was followed by the -200 PF. The PF was package freighter and was first operated by United Postal Service Airways. The PF can hold 15 containers in its main hold with an additional 1,830 cubic feet of cargo in its lower holds. It has a large port side cargo door located just aft of the cockpit. It can operate on transatlantic routes without ETOPS restriction. A total of 80 of this version were built. The next version would be the -200M. Unlike the PF variant, the 200M is a combi. The aircraft has a convertible main deck that can be used for either cargo or passengers. It retains both the windows of the -200 and the cargo door of the PF. Two pallets and 148 passengers are able to be carried simultaneously. The launch customer for this variant would be the Royal Nepal Airlines. The 200 SFs are conversions of the passenger 200s to full-on cargo. DHL was the first customer of these, and Boeing Wichita would strengthen the floors and add the port side cargo door to the standard airliner 200. The last major variant for passengers was the 757-300. Condor Airlines began flights with the 300 in 1999. The -300 has a fuselage plug fore and aft of the wing to increase its length. The fuselage goes from 155 feet to 178 feet. This allows room for upwards of 50 more passengers depending upon the interiors and seat pitch. Production of this version totaled 55 aircraft, and all but one are currently still in service. The first military delivery of the aircraft occurred when the Mexican Air Force took delivery of a VIP-configured -200 for use in its presidential flight. The call sign is TP-01, or Transport Presidential Uno. The Argentinian Air Force flies the president of Argentina in a 75 under the call sign of Tango 1. New Zealand's Air Force has two 200M combis, in which they use to support their prime minister. They also have landed one at Pegasus Airfield to support New Zealand's Scott Base in Antarctica. The first airlift squadron of the 89th Airlift Wing at Joint Base Andrews flies six VC-32As. The C-32 has a revised interior with a fully enclosed stateroom, complete with a fold-out bed and shower. It carries a crew of 16 and 45 passengers. All of the C-32s were retrofitted with blended winglets. The primary mission of the C-32A is to be the transport to the Vice President of the United States. His call sign is Air Force Two. They also support POTUS if he's flying into an airport that cannot handle the VC-25A or 747. Lastly, there are two very special C-32Bs that fly out of Joint McGuire-Dix Lakehurst. The two C-32Bs from the 277th Special Operations Flight. These all-white aircraft support the Foreign Emergency Support Team of the U.S. State Department. They are fitted with 48 seats and cargo is carried in the rear of the aircraft. FEST is a go-bag team made up of members of the FBI, State Department, Department of Energy, Defense Department, and other intelligence assets. They deploy when there's an act or incident overseas that might involve terrorism. These are the longest-range 757s in the world with a 6,000-plus nautical range. This is because fore and aft holds are now fuel tanks instead of storage. They are also self-sufficient with additional APUs, carry spares for tires and engines in a small aft hold. Lastly, but more importantly, these two are the only 757s capable of air-to-air refueling in the world. 757s ended production on October 28, 2004, after 1,050 aircraft were produced. Currently, Delta is the operator. So, let's run the randomizer and see what next week's dogfight is. We will be dogfighting an Aronca Model 7 Champ versus a Curtis Robin. So go out to Facebook and vote, early and often. This is David M. Vanderhoof, your Airplane Geeks, signing off. And here's Grant and Steve.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, December 3rd, 2012.
Well, g'day, folks, and welcome back to the Australia Desk for episode number 226. Well, Grant, I tell you what, we tried for a couple of weeks to leave Qantas out of the Australia Desk reports, but I tell you what, mate, 2 weeks we leave them alone, and look what's happened behind our backs.
I know. They go out and become the launch company for Airbus's iPad flight bag. Ugh, mate, it's an iPad app, it's from Airbus, and it's an EFB. Why wasn't it Android?
I don't know, mate. I think they might have a few more, let's say, important things to worry about there at Qantas based on the news that's been brewing the last couple of weeks. I don't think iPad and Android are foremost in their thoughts right now.
I don't know. I guess I should have seen it coming with all the reports about how they were giving everyone iPads. I thought that was bad enough. But yeah, I mean, I bet there's a few teeth gnashing in Boeing that they're going as a launch customer for an Airbus iPad flight bag. But hang on. You seem to be indicating there's something bigger.
Well, maybe that was just the final straw for a rebel group of investors who've been rumored for the last few weeks, or maybe even the last few months, to have been plotting against Alan Joyce. And some interestingly familiar names amongst that supposed rebel group.
Oh, you mean it's time to get out the tinfoil hats? You mean our sources were correct? We've had people hassling us for the last few weeks, telling us all the rumors going on inside Qantas, and we've started to see it all break last week, but we were too busy having fun with the C-130Hs, and it's all come to the boil now. Dixon and his mate Joyce are no longer friends.
Hang on, do you mean the former CEO Jeff Dixon, who famously said this?
And I'm sorry, I don't apologise.
When asked about all the things that he'd done at Qantas?
That would be him, and in fact, I think it's definitely time for the tinfoil hats, buddy, because here we go. See, what happened was the conspiracy theory rumour was that Dixon was grooming Joyce to run Qantas, not so much into the ground, but at least drop the share price a lot so that Dixon and his mates, like Singleton, who happens to run a lot of ad agencies that Qantas puts money into, and various other financial backers, could actually take over and run Qantas the way they wanted and give Joyce a nice big reward. But it looks like Joyce has decided to go out on his own. He's decided, no, I'm going to turn around and bite the hand that feeds me. I'm going to be the mouse that roars. I'm going to hook us up with Emirates. And since then, well, all proverbial hell has broken loose in the Qantas political world.
Good Lord, is that you, Grant McCarron, or is that Adam Curry I'm listening to? My goodness.
Well, mate, I may have been listening to a few episodes of No Agenda with Adam Curry and John C. Dvorak, but no, this was being told to me by other people, not just my own deranged imagination.
All right, so let's go through some of the articles that we've got here. We've got a stack of them, and we hope we don't take up more than about 20 minutes going through it. Just kidding, Rob.
Basically, Dixon and Joyce have had a falling out, and because Joyce has gone with Emirates, Dixon doesn't agree with this, and so his rival faction group are now saying that Joyce is bad and that they want to take over Qantas, and they'll sell off the frequent flyer program, float Jetstar, and rebuild Qantas International and make it the once beautiful thing that it used to be, which is really, really interesting given... Well, I think this quote really sums it up, doesn't it, Steve?
Yeah, this quote comes from Geoffrey Thomas of Air Transport World and Australian Aviation.
Alan Joyce is going through a very tough period, as is the entire airline industry. But what we have to remember here is most of the challenges that Alan Joyce faces at the moment were decisions made on Jeff Dixon's watch and also before him, James Strong's watch. There were bad decisions made at Qantas. They're trying to unravel those right now.
Now, that's an interesting comment there by Geoffrey Thomas, who's one of the most respected aviation journalists in this country, I might point out. And Grant, it's interesting that the whole time that Dixon was in charge of Qantas, Alan Joyce was actually not on that board. At that time, Alan Joyce was running Jetstar.
That's right, mate. He became the CEO of Qantas after Dixon left, and it was a... pair off between Joyce and Borghetti, and the board decided to go with Joyce, who was groomed in Dixon's image and would continue the same decisions and processes the way Dixon had created. And we all know what happened there. Qantas got Joyce and Virgin got Borghetti and have just grown and grown and grown since then. In fact, right now it's got so fractious between Joyce and Dixon that Joyce has actually dumped Tourism Australia. Qantas have been putting a lot of money into Tourism Australia to help promote Australia, get more people coming in. And Joyce has said because Dixon is the chairman of the board of Tourism Australia and Dixon is trying to undermine and destabilize Qantas, that they've actually decided to dump Tourism Australia and no longer fund them. I mean, how amazing is that? As if that wasn't enough, the still call Australia home thing. Guess who's stepping in to fill the void? Who do you think it might be, Steve?
Well, I don't know, Grant. Do you think it might have been somebody else who used to be at the top of Qantas right there at the right hand of Jeff Dixon himself?
I think you could be right, mate. In fact, I alluded to him and even mentioned his name. That's right, Borghetti was seen having drinks with Jeff Dixon and confirmed that they have been discussing Virgin Australia stepping in to fill the void when Qantas funding runs out.
Now, the amount of money that Qantas is going to pull out of Tourism Australia, which is basically a government promotional organisation to basically bring tourists into Australia, we're talking in excess of $40 million. Now, you know, Virgin is now at least considering, by all reports, jumping in to fill that gap. Now, it's important to note here that Virgin already has a memorandum of understanding with Tourism Australia. It's just looking now at perhaps putting in some more money. And interestingly, Grant, Singapore Airlines and Air New Zealand are also reported to be wanting to fill that gap from Qantas. So it's not going to hurt Tourism Australia too much, I suppose, except, of course, that Qantas is far more recognised as the national flag carrier than Virgin Australia is. But once again, we see John Borghetti, the former top man at Qantas, now running Virgin. And it'll be really interesting to see here if he is going to now step in and take yet another slice of the Qantas pie, even if it's as a result of their own doing.
Exactly, mate. It's getting really fascinating. The opposition have called on Tourism Minister Martin Ferguson to step in and mediate a resolution to the damaging dispute between Qantas and Tourism Australia. Mate, this is just like when Joyce grounded Qantas and the opposition was jumping up and down, the government was running all around the place. It's all go again. This is great.
There's a lot of very big names in Australian business being tied up in this this very convoluted plot. So I'm sure that we'll be following this over the next few weeks and months. This is going to take a long time to go away. So we might just leave that there for this week. But as I said, I'm sure we will be coming back to it for many more reports to come.
Sad but true, dude. Sad but true.
Absolutely. It is very sad. But speaking of things that are coming home and for actually quite happy reasons, let's just mention quickly that Australia's last AP3C Orion aircraft has arrived back home from the Middle East area of operations. We reported that the drawdown of those aircraft was happening starting a couple of months ago, and that's now concluded. All of our Orions are back in Australia, so that's wonderful news.
Yay! It's great news for the the Orion fleet to be back here. It's lousy news for anyone who's trying to do naughty things in our territorial waters, because the eye in the sky is back.
Absolutely. And of course, those aircraft are based at RAF Base Edinburgh, which is near Adelaide in South Australia. Now, we talked about the huge amount of fun we had last week at the C-130H retirement services. And of course, the final day of operations for those aircraft was on November 30th. The aircraft did the last of their big public displays, and were given a great big signing off ceremony with all the big chiefs from the Defence Force there up at RAF Base Richmond. And those aircraft now sail off into Australian Defence Force history, Grant. But I tell you what, one good news story is that it's rumoured, at least, that one of those aircraft will be making its way down here to Melbourne to Point Cook, which is the home of the Royal Australian Air Force Museum. So it looks like at least one of them, hopefully at least, will be here on display and preserved for all time. That's great news.
That's the indication, mate. Four are going to the Indonesian Air Force. Two are being retained by the RAF for training purposes at RAF Richmond. And, of course, the Air Force Museum at Point Cook. So it looks like that's more than just a rumor. It looks like it's got some basis of fact behind it, but we'll believe it when it lands at Point Cook. And the remaining six aircraft, there's a chance Indonesia may buy a few more as well.
Well, let's hope so, because we don't want to see those aircraft scrapped. You know what I reckon with those aircraft, Grant? Imagine if some civilian operator got his hands on them with our large mining industry. What great aircraft they would be for operations around the mining industry. Just an idea. I mean,
we've already heard how good they were in Papua New Guinea.
Yeah, probably not practical, but, I think it'd be fantastic. And I tell you what, they'd have no shortage of trained, highly qualified air crews to operate them in their spare time.
That much is certain. And I'll tell you what, mate, if it's going cheap enough, I don't know. The PCDU C-130, we've been joking about it for a while. It'd be pretty awesome, wouldn't it?
Yeah, now if some company starts up here in the next few weeks and decides to make a fortune out of that, I want a consulting fee for the idea, Grant.
No, you just want a few more rides.
Yeah, I'll take a few more of those. Any day of the week, mate.
There you go, mate. There you go.
Well, that's everything we have for you on this week's Australia Desk, but fear not, Grant. I think we'll have lots more Qantas news next week.
Oh, no, mate. I'm pretty sure you'll be right.
Absolutely. Well, coming up next is Peter Johnson with Across the Pond, this week talking about futuristic aircraft.
A lot of times, like many interested in aviation, I dream about flying, aircraft, and the whole aviation experience. But for some, that vision to seek something futuristic or different becomes a reality. And this week on Across the Pond, we talk to Laurent Barreau from Octori, who is today speaking to us from Toulouse in France. Laurent is an aviation designer who's normally found designing interiors for airliners, but today we're talking to him about some of his stunning aircraft of the future designs. Laurent, welcome across the pond.
Good morning, Peter.
Well, thank you very much for joining us. Can we just start by explaining to us why you're designing concept aircraft for the future?
I was designing futuristic aircraft concept since a few years, and it was like a private hobby. I was not really showing because I was afraid about looking like a teenager still making some very odd aircraft. To answer your question, why am I doing that? First, because I do not have TV, so I've got to find some occupation to myself. And then I'm a creative guy, so if I don't do something new, I'm getting bored. So here I was trying to generate some new concepts, being free to think without any goal except being innovative or creative, a new idea.
Your designs are absolutely fabulous, and for those of us who have seen them, they're quite fantastic. But how practical are they? Are they capable of flying?
So if I want to make a straight answer, if they remain as they are, I wouldn't take part of the flying test. This is for sure. I know what is a flying aircraft. So, in fact, to answer your question, some of them are pure science fiction aircraft.
Yeah.
So they cannot work. Some other, with some serious engineering work on the top of it, I mean, keeping in mind the concept, but really applying some engineering solution, yeah. I believe it would be feasible. Here I'm thinking about the flying yacht project. I really believe a craft being able to behave as a boat and flying in the meantime is quite it's quite feasible. So here, if I had to do it on with a more realistic approach, I would take the Ekranoplan approach as the Russian were doing in the past, plus combined with some sales. Yeah, I think it would do the job. So here I make it short, but I believe it would work. So
right, okay. And like lots of futuristic designs that we can look back on in the past, some elements of those designs actually come into being, and it may not be the whole project, but certainly small parts of it. You design both aircraft and the interiors. Did you think that some of your interior designs may become a reality?
One might become true. I've been contacted by a Canadian company. The chairman visited my website and he wanted me to generate an interior concept for his new project. So this new project is called the Flying Yacht. So it's very similar to one of my projects.
Yeah.
And I've been asked to create an interior design concept based on real inputs. So this new project is released since only a few months, I believe. And this one could be made. If one guy is in love with this project, it could be made for sure.
And some of the designs on the interior of some of your aircraft, they potentially could go into the corporate area. I mean, some of the seating, the lighting, and some of those ideas could be developed into corporate aircraft, couldn't they?
Yeah, for sure. In fact, when you start a cabin interior, you've got to start by the layout. So top view, locating seats, sofa, bars, and everything. So this is one of the biggest part of the job. And in my case, my difficulty is that I do not have any client in front of me. A normal decision would be to have a client. So the guy is giving you inputs about what you would like to see, how we would like to use the cabin. And this is really the case for VIP aircraft. So you're talking to the client and you ask, okay, what do you intend to do? Do you need to work in your aircraft? Do you need to relax? Do you need to have a bedroom or a bathroom and so on? So this is for sure. I'm using the same way of working as for VIP aircraft.
Yeah. Now, my favorite design, looking through the website, obviously there are power and propulsion systems. There are all sorts of different designs and concepts you've got there. But my favorite one has got to be the flying yacht. And it's a 3,000 passenger aircraft. Do you think we'll ever see anything like that flying in the world at any time in the future?
So I believe you are talking about the aircraft of the cities or the city aircraft.
Oh, right, yes.
So I would say why not? I don't see why it couldn't. I mean, technically, I think we can do it.
Yeah.
Then is there an interest to make aircraft with such high passenger capacity? It's really, really difficult to answer this question because even aircraft manufacturers, they are spending a lot of time in doing marketing studies and to investigate if a new concept is matching a market requirement.
Yeah.
So in my case, I can only say I believe it could be made. Then is there a market for that? I cannot answer. So,
well, Lauren, I've really enjoyed looking at your work and certainly hearing your thoughts on the future. Your website is stunning. The designs are stunning. And where can our listeners find out a little bit more about your work?
So if some guys are buying some airline aircraft, they might see me. There is a potential chance we meet. Okay, this is a very tough approach. And then if some people are interested to get in contact with me, they can do it through my website. Then let's say I'm making a clear split in between my professional activity and my hobby activity. So I will be pleased to answer any question of of any sort. If some guys are interested by some of my work or me to be involved in some project, no problem, they can contact me.
Right, and we'll put links to your website and to your Twitter feed in the show notes. I'd love to come back and have another talk with you, Lauren. I don't even think we've touched the surface on this, but thank you very much for your time.
Thanks to you. Yeah, we finally made it, so weeks of negotiation.
Yeah, it's wonderful. Thanks very much.
Thanks to you.
This is Peter Johnson reporting for the Airplane Geeks from across the pond.
Yeah, thanks, Peter. This guy is an amazing designer. The website is octuri.com, www.octuri.com. And these designs are just, they're indescribable. They're, you know, very futuristic, very amazing. This guy is an artist. This guy is a visionary. I'm really glad Peter got a hold of him. Rob, can you see yourself flying around in any kind of aircraft that look like these?
It's funny that you say that because I was looking at that. Sorry, I didn't come right up here. I was looking at the flying yacht, actually, and I got kind of mesmerized. It's an incredible concept, but isn't that the wonderful thing about meeting people like that when you realize that there are people that are so many light years ahead of most of the rest of the pack? 25 years from now, people will say, oh, yeah, that was pretty. Yeah, I guess that was okay, but we can't even imagine that right now because some of this looks so far out.
Yeah, it's great. So, yeah, to all of our listeners, encourage you to go take a look. It's quite impressive. All right, let's move on to some listener mail. We got an email from Brett. He's talking about the engine we were discussing a few episodes ago, the Snecma Silvercrest engine. He says that while the sound of a turbofan engine with no TBO sounds great, I wonder how this works for the folks planning the maintenance cycles for aircraft. TBO, time between overhauls. So the deal on the Snecma Silvercrest engine is that unlike many other engines that have a fixed number of cycles or life before overhauls are required, this does not. And you monitor the condition, and then as it's warranted, you perform the maintenance. So Brett's saying, gee, well, doesn't that make it awfully tough to plan your maintenance and have the proper spare parts in place and that kind of thing? And, I mean, I can see what he's saying. I mentioned to Brett in an email back to him that at least for many larger commercial engines, the engine manufacturers like to sell maintenance plans where that service is provided, sometimes based on an hourly rate, a flight hourly kind of a rate. And I don't know if that's the case with this Snecma Silvercrest engine, but yeah, predictability of maintenance costs is something that, you know, any operator is very interested in. So maybe we can, as we go along here, learn some more about how Snecma intends to approach that. We'll pass that on. Brett also commented on our conversation with Dan Hampton, the F-16 pilot, author of Viper Pilot. And he went out and bought the ebook and enjoyed it a lot. But Brett's asking if there are any other interesting books about pilot experiences that we can recommend. So, David, do you have any books that you might recommend? Any good reads?
My favorite biography of a pilot happens to be there's a book called First Blue, which is about Butch Voris. Who the reason why it's First Blue was he's Blue Angel number one. He was the one who formed the Blue Angels back in 1945, 1946. If you haven't read Yeager's autobiography, that should be a must read. The Right Stuff is another must read. I can come up with some other ones off the top of my head, but definitely hunt down First Blue. It's a really good read, and you have to get when someone creates something and it lasts over 50 plus years. That's pretty impressive.
Did you read the Robin Olds book, David? I wish I could think of the name of it. you know, the guy that was the Phantom, was a Phantom pilot in Vietnam.
I read it years ago.
I can't think of the name of the title right now. Well, that is the name, but anyway,
yeah,
I like that. But I also like Fate is the Hunter. I mean, that's an old one. That's an airline pilot book, but that's Ernest Gahn's book from, I probably wrote that 50 years ago or something.
Also in episode 96 of Plane Crazy Down Under, they interviewed a former RAF F-18 pilot, Mac Serge Tucker, and he's got a book that those guys recommend. It's titled Fighter Pilot Misadventures Beyond the Sound Barrier with an Australian Top Gun. And that's episode 96 of Plane Crazy Down Under. And we'll put a link in the show notes to that episode. So that's another option. Hey, we also heard from Marcus. Marcus says that he listens to the show. He's a pilot, and he's also a podcaster. And he publishes a science podcast. It's called Omega Tau, which is at omegataupodcast.net. And some of his episodes cover aviation topics. One of them is a 2-hour interview with a former U-2 pilot, which is very interesting. And he has some other stuff as well, some other aviation things as well. He interviewed a former SR-71 pilot. So that might be worth checking out. I recommend that. We'll put those links in the show notes too. And we got a question from Bob. Bob said that he's been reading up on the SU-47, and he sees some information that the cockpit control has a tensiometric throttle control. Tensiometric. And he was asking us, what does that mean? So I think, David, you can explain that. Rob, you might know, too. I don't know.
Interesting enough, Bob, if you do a Google search for tensiometric throttle control, you get the same hit over and over and over again, and it's about to percoot. I did some further research. It's a hands-on, what they call HOTAS, which is hands-on throttle and stick, which means that you never take your hands off the throttle and some of your other controls are on it. Normally, a throttle on an airplane on the left-hand side moves backwards and forwards, depending upon what you want to generate the thrust with the air. This is a fixed stick like you would have on the right-hand side, where you are just moving this, you're not moving the whole stick, you're just pressing it to increase thrust or pulling it back. So it's based on the tension and the tightness in which you grip the stick to determine thrust. I don't know how effective it is, but it's a fly-by-wire technology. I know, and there isn't much about it other than the article you read that mentioned it. So maybe I'll turn it over to Rob. Any mention on Airbus's about tensiomatic throttle controls?
Yeah. David, I'm having a little trouble with the connection there. I guess I didn't quite hear that question. Well, maybe next week, guys. Yeah, I wish I could say I knew something about that, but I do not. Hopefully a listener does.
Yeah, I tried to look around for some information on that as well. And yeah, there isn't a whole lot out there, at least that I could find either. But yeah, I gather what you said, David, it's a control that doesn't move, but instead it's got a strain gauge or something associated with it. It measures the pressure you apply to it, not squeezing pressure.
Rude jokes can come out of the fact word strain gauge.
Well, that's you know what a strain gauge is, right? You remember that from your engineering courses, right, in college?
What engineering courses in college?
What did you study in college, David?
Damn it, Jim. I'm a historian, not an engineer.
That's right. Okay. So if anyone has any more experience than we do with tensiometric throttle controls, pass it along, and we'll do the same. All right, we heard from Ray. Actually, we heard from a couple of listeners who sent in some links to some interesting articles. Ray sent in one from the Courier Journal, NTSB Seeks a Better Fire System in All Cargo Planes. And this is an article about, what it says is that cargo planes need the ability to prevent fires that have occurred over the past. In some cases, resulting in pilot deaths. And the FAA, without specifying what kind of technology it has in mind, is saying that there should be a requirement that airlines install these some kind of devices. And this also kind of coincided with an announcement from UPS that it has developed a system that can address fires in shipments, even of lithium batteries, which I think have been a problem in the past. We've read about some of those stories in the news. Those things burn at really, really hot temperatures. So we'll put a link to the article that Ray sent to us in the show notes. And Kevin sent us one also. This was a big deal. This is from the Financial Post. Bombardier wins $3.1 billion order with VistaJet. So this is the largest single firm order for business jets in the history of Bombardier. It's 56 global aircraft, a little over $3 billion to VistaJet Holding, which is a Swiss charter company, and they're looking to expand into some other markets. Rob, are you familiar with this airplane, Rob?
Oh, you mean the Global?
Yeah, the Global.
Oh, yeah, it's a fairly sophisticated airplane. I mean, the Global's sort of a competitive airplane with the Gulfstreams, the high-end large cabin aircraft, long range. The newest Globals are going to be up in the 7,000 mile range category, which I don't care what kind of an airplane you're on. That's a long time to be in an airplane.
It is. And we got a note from Isaac. Actually, he tweeted this, I believe. People may or may not know about Twitter lists. You can create a list of people in some category, whatever you like. We actually have a few of those ourselves. We have one Twitter list, which is just us, the hosts here. We have another Twitter list that represents all of the guests we've had on the podcast, or almost all the guests, those that we had Twitter handles for. And let's see, there's another one for Across the Pond guests, and you can sort of follow those lists to follow that collection of folks. Well, Isaac has put together some aviation Twitter lists that you can take a look at. Might be interesting to follow some of those. You can find those at twitter.com/jetcitystar/lists. So thanks, Isaac, for sending those in. That's really nice. Anybody else has got some interesting lists that they like, some Twitter lists, send them along, and we'll pass them along. And just wanted to mention both Richard Sechrist and John Arvin sent along links to the news item that we touched on with the Chinese carrier, the landings and takeoff on the Chinese carrier, and we have links to those stories. They have a video. The Chinese released a video of that activity, and I thought it was kind of interesting that those guys, they even did a FOD walk, which was pretty impressive. So it may be a new aircraft carrier for them, new processes for them, David, but they definitely have the FOD walk routine down cold.
Well, FOD walks are important.
You've done one of those yourself.
Well, I've done several FOD walks over time, but
you did one at the Smithsonian, didn't you?
Yes, we actually did a FOD walk at Be a Pilot Day. We do a FOD walk to clean off the flight lines for all of the active aircraft that are coming in. So FOD walks are interesting. They're unique. And for most people who hang around military airfields, that's the first thing you do every morning is march the line to make sure that things like stones don't get sucked up into multi-million dollar jet engines.
Yeah, they don't like that. All right, that'll do it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks Podcast. I want to thank all of you for listening to the show. I want to thank our guest, Jason Blair. He's the executive director of the National Association of Flight Instructors. And just a sort of a special thanks to Andy Matthews from iFlight Planner for helping us get connected to Jason. We want to thank our contributors, Graham McCarron and Steve Vischer. You can find them at planecrazydownunder.com. And Peter Johnson, who you can find at alphatangopapa.blogspot.com. and also aviation-extended.co.uk. No E on extended. All right. Let's tell folks where they can find each of us online. So, David Vanderhoof, we will start with you. Where can people find you online?
You can find me counting the days till the end of the world on December 21st, 2012. Oh, yeah. So I'm preventing, I'm skipping doing Christmas shopping this year. Otherwise you can find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me, and don't forget to go vote on our Airplane Geeks Airplane of the Week dogfight. And all of the other places, because you listen every week, you know where I am.
Great. And Rob Mark, where do people find you?
Well, they find us in Chicagoland on Jetwine, on Twitter. They find us at jetwine.com on the blog. They find me on Facebook. But this week, they'll find me trying to pull strings to get the Champ to be the airplane that David talks about next week, because I learned to fly in a version of one of those, and so I'm somewhat partial to it.
Cool. All right.
Oh, and can we just mention one more thing?
Yeah, sure.
Send us those Christmas greetings. No one's listening to this piece of the show anyway, right?
Yeah, we need to do something to spice this up, huh?
If you listen to this part of the show and get all the way to the bloopers, send us your email and maybe we'll do something special for you.
A teaser. Okay, and don't tell anyone else. Just for you people who are listening. Okay, and I'm Max Flight. You can look for me on Google Plus and Twitter as Max Flight. Also, you can check out my aviation directory at 30,000feet.com. You can find show notes for this episode at airplanegeeks.com. This is episode 226. And be sure to follow us on Twitter and Facebook and Google Plus. Just look for Airplane Geeks. We're also on Stitcher.com, where you can stream us right to your mobile phone. If you want to send us email, we have an address for that. That's thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And of course, we have a listener line where you can leave us an audio message. And Benay Wilson has that number.
And if you want to call the Airplane Geeks, you can dial 361-GEEKS-01.
Thanks, Aunt Benay. Opening and closing music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. So, join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
The Airplane Geeks podcast is sponsored by the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association. Visit aopa.org/learn-to-fly for your introduction to the exciting world of aviation and flight. God. Who is that voice? You know what that voice sounds like? That voice sounds like my wife when she's trying to imitate her mother.
Actually, or it could have been Tiny Tim.
It could have been Tiny Tim.
God bless us, everyone.
We'll have to call that Tiny Rob.
Oh, God, yes. Because I keep shrinking every year.
I mean, that's no different than the Onion running North Korea's current president as the sexiest man alive and them picking up the story. So it's... I mean, China, congratulations. You have an aircraft carrier, it's going to take a long time for you to learn how to use it.
And Rob, this is an organization that would recommend, right?
Well, I think based on the cool certificate I got. Yeah.
Hey, you got to remember, you got a membership card along with that also.
Oh, that's right. And I got a membership card. The only thing I didn't get, though, Jason, I was kind of waiting for the secret decoder ring, you know, that we used to... And I didn't see a copy of the secret handshake this year. So
website to get
because that changes stuff.
Okay, and now with his This Week in Aviation, here's David Vent. Are we still calling this Week in Aviation?
Oh, just call it.
And now here's David. Yeah.
We can call it last week in aviation.
Last week, the previous week in aviation. It's
another time. Another time.
Some other time, not today, but. And now here's David's.
Supposed rebel group.
You are part of the Rebel Alliance and a traitor. Take her away.
Sorry, had to do it.
So David, on your on the airplane of the week.
Yeah.
I was kind of disappointed.
Why?
Because I had a whole bunch of like engine information that I was going to pop into the, you know, interject and sort of fill out the story, except that you said almost all of it.
Sorry.
Yeah, you covered it all. You even got the dash model on the RB211.
Well, no, what I thought was really kind of amazing was I was visiting my vendor over by McGuire, and I saw this strange white 757 doing touch and goes out of the airfield. I now know what that strange white 757 is.
Yeah. He didn't before.
And who knew that there were 757s that could be air-to-air refueled?
Yeah, no idea. So here's one for you. Can you name the two other aircraft that used the same Pratt & Whitney engine as on the 757? Two other aircraft used that same engine.
An Airbus something?
Nope.
Followed by something else? I don't know. I'm not engines. Lead-known airliners.
The C-17.
Oh.
The C-17 uses four of it. It's the military designation is the F-117 engine. That's the military designation.
Well, then I would never equate that with. Yeah.
It's slightly different, but essentially similar.
I was
going
to say, the 7.5 doesn't have thrust reversers like a 7.7 C-17, does it?
Maybe. Maybe they're the same. I think they're probably. I don't know, because we don't make the thrust reversers. But I'm not sure. But the other aircraft with the 2037s, the PW-2037s. You'd never guess this. Actually, it was the PW-2337.
Okay.
An Aleutian, the IL-96. They got off the ground, but the four-engine IL-96.
The Aleutian 767.
I guess this thing kind of died for lack of financing. And so I don't think it ever went into service, but the idea was that would use the same engine.
Oh, okay. Well, I learned something.
So there you have it.
You want me to do something in the meantime?
Sure.
No, I'm sorry. I was swearing up and down because I was on mute, so I figured I better stop swearing first before I come off.
Yeah, wise decision.